Chapter 6, Part 2. He's sitting at a table and Tony is sitting on his left and the rest of the room is packed with reporters. There are three huge cameras. Most of the major news services are transmitting this live. Light gleams in Steve's eyes. Under the cowl, he's sweating. He wonders if wearing the uniform was a mistake. While Steve has retreated into the comforting confines of formality, sitting ramrod straight, Tony leans back, relaxed, at ease. He's not drinking. There's only the slightest hint of his usual cavalier behavior, but he's sitting there like nothing fazes him, smiling ever so slightly at the crowd. Tony's mind is vibrating like a plucked string, though. Inside his head, where only Steve can see, he's nervous, too. They agreed that Steve, leader of the Ultimates, would deliver the news. Like it's any ordinary bit of team information. He glances down at the cards in his hands and lifts his head. "Greetings," he says. "I'd like to thank you all for coming. I'll make this brief. 5 days ago, the Ultimates were engaged in a routine training session. During an exercise simulating an aerial bombardment, Tony Stark," he glances over at Tony, who gives the crowd a winning smile, "was accidentally struck by one of the non-lethal projectiles used in these training exercises." There's some murmuring. They can't figure out why he's telling them this. A few people are worrying about Tony's health. God, if they only knew. "I'm fine," Tony puts in with that same charming smile. "I was wearing the armor." Steve clears her throat. "A minor mechanical malfunction following the impact caused Mr. Stark to need to be removed from the armor as soon as possible after landing. I was the closest available responder and I pulled him free." The cue cards blur before his eyes and he drops them on the table and looks up. Here goes nothing. He tries to smile. "And, well, the long and short of it is..." Oh God, he can't say it. He can't. He's a coward. They're all going to know what he really is now. "It's all right," Tony says in his head. He's easy, confident, calming, and Steve hates how much he likes it. "Breathe. I got you covered." "We have a soul bond," Tony finishes, smoothly. There is a cacophony of lights, noise, shouting. So many people with so many questions. "One at a time," Tony shouts over the din. "One at a time, please." He points seemingly at random to a man in the front row. "You. Has this been confirmed medically?" Tony nods. "Shield has scanned us both fully and we've passed the usual battery of telepathy and empathy tests." He grins. "Plus, I can hear him in my head. Captain America's an awfully distinctive guy." The crowd chuckles, and Steve wonders what Tony means by that, distinctive. If it's positive. If Tony even likes him. "Mr. Stark," another man shouts, "how do you expect this to affect your performance on the Ultimates?" Tony gives the crowd another one of those 1,000-watt camera-ready smiles. The inside of his mind has settled down into something cool, prepared. For Tony, this is a battlefield, one he spent years fighting on. His domain, his natural habitat. "Only in the best of ways," Tony says with another smile. "I imagine that always being in contact can only be a positive tactical development. We haven't really had the chance to practice in the field yet. It's been a busy week." There are small titters of laughter in the back of the room quickly cut off. Steve realizes in ashamed horror that the entire room thinks he and Tony are fucking. That they've probably spent the past few days in bed. "Yeah, they probably do think that," Tony observes. "But what the hell does it matter what they think?" "I can't," Steve says. And it's like he's hit a wall inside himself. He doesn't know what's on the other side. He doesn't even know who he is. "Tony, I can't." He can feel panic rising up, an oncoming tide. He knows what Tony wants him to say. He knows what Tony wants him to think. He knows Tony wants him to be perfectly okay with this, 100%. He knows he's nowhere near close. They both know that. It's okay. Tony's radiating a serene calm. Steve doesn't know where he's getting it from, but however Tony's doing it, it's bringing him down, nice and easy. You're doing great. He guesses that somehow Tony must like him after all. Even if Tony didn't want this. Even if he's a disappointment, because he can't do what Tony obviously must want from his soulmate. Even if Steve's fucking it all up. Tony looks at him like he wants to make him feel better, but isn't sure how. Steve can feel him discarding statements, biting them back before Steve can quite tell what they are, even with the soul bond. You aren't a disappointment, Tony says, finally, and Steve doesn't even know how to respond to that. A journalist in the second row stands up. A question for Captain America? Yes, Steve says. Oh boy, here we go, Tony says. Given that you have been rather famously romantically linked with Gail Barnes, Nee Richards, and more recently with your teammate Janet Pym, she asks, did it come as a surprise to you to find that your soulmate was Tony Stark? Steve takes a deep breath. As I'm sure you can imagine, he begins, having any soulmate at all came as a very large surprise. The crowd chuckles politely. But I assume that what you're actually asking me is whether I was surprised that my soulmate was a man, and that you're not asking Tony this question because he's... He doesn't know what words to use for Tony. Notoriously open-minded, darling, Tony says, and there are smiles all through the crowd. The woman gives a very slight nod. Yeah, that's definitely what she wants to know. Oh God. You probably shouldn't punch her, Tony informs him. Keep breathing, darling. Read the cards. He has cards for this. He knew they were going to ask him this. He came prepared. He has a carefully constructed answer about the magnitude of this development and the need for privacy that all basically boils down to none of your business. But it isn't anyone's business, really, what's in a set. Well, other than Tony now, anyway. He turns the cards face down in his hands, looks up, swallows hard, and smiles. Tony told him the truth. He can tell the truth for Tony. Honestly, Steve says, and he can feel his face crease in another rueful smile. He was probably the last person in the world I would have expected. He knows as he says it that he's going to get pilloried in the press. They don't care about honesty or respect or decency. But he needs to say this. He clears his throat. It was a shock, that's for sure. I never imagined that if I had a soulmate, he'd be a man. I didn't even know it was possible. Though I am, as they say, from a different era. No one really talked about this back then. The crowd shifts nervously. They don't know where he's going with this. He can feel Tony's mind coiled up, electric. Tony doesn't know where he's going either. He takes another breath. I was raised to believe that a soul bond was a blessing, a miracle, a gift from God. I don't know if that's a real popular belief these days, but it's what I learned. A soulmate is the other half of your soul, and that's not really something you have a say in. And so I don't rightly know that it matters so much that I didn't expect it to be Tony. It matters that it is Tony. Maybe I wouldn't have picked him if I'd had a choice, but the way I see it, ma'am, it wasn't my choice. Someone else did the picking for me, and he knows better than I do, and maybe that means I didn't know as much about myself as I thought I did. He coughs. I'm still coming to terms with what that means. But Tony's the right one for me. He has to be. He manages another smile. I can't say this is easy for me, but I'm trying, and I'm getting used to having him around. I think that's a start. The room is silent. No one seems to know what to say. Tony's mind is ringing bright with awe and something that feels a lot like pride, and Steve doesn't know what to do with that. He realizes he's shaking. He doesn't feel scared, but he's shaking like he just took down a tank battalion with his fists alone. Tony leans over, plucks the card out of his trembling hands, and then, gently, delicately, slides two fingers under the edge of Steve's glove stretching up until he can just barely brush Steve's bare skin right there in front of God and everybody. "You're very brave." Tony's mental voice is a hushed whisper. "You know that?" Steve wants to shy away, embarrassed, but Tony's in his mind and there is nowhere to go. "It was just the truth," he mutters. "You don't think the truth is brave?" Tony asks. Steve doesn't know what to say. Tony leans in closer to Steve. Their shoulders bump. Tony's still holding his hand. "For the record," Tony says, beaming to the reporter, "I think he's amazing." All the cameras go off at once. Amazing. Somehow it doesn't feel quite so terrifying when Tony says it. It turns out that the press loves them. Apparently Tony was right. And Steve, well, then Steve asks Tony out. Sort of. Steve doesn't actually ask Tony to go with them until the morning of the roast the next day, mostly because he figures Tony will say no, and also because he's not really sure of the etiquette surrounding, "So I had been going to bring my girlfriend, but now she's left me because I have a soulmate." Not to mention the fact that Jen had never really been all that keen on socializing with Gale and Bucky, and surely if there's anyone who doesn't want to spend time with a bunch of octogenarians, it would be the glamorous jet-setting CEO Tony Stark. Steve knows what his luck is like by now. Even his soulmate won't want to spend time with him. He still doesn't know what to feel about the part of himself that definitely wants to see more of Tony. He finally musters up the courage to ask Tony at about 0700 while he's still sitting at home with a cup of coffee. There is no point in being any more formal when Tony is just going to decline, and there's really no need to do it in person when Tony can hear everything he thinks. Besides, maybe not having to look at him will make the inevitable rejection hurt less. "Yeah, sure, of course." Tony's mental voice is perfectly sincere, if slightly sleep-fogged. Coffee sloshes as Steve nearly drops his mug in surprise.
"Wait, yes?"
"Yes," Tony says, a little cautiously, his mind suddenly wary, like he doesn't understand why Steve is still waiting for Tony to pull the rug out from under his feet.
"Was I not supposed to say yes?"
Steve doesn't quite intend to push his memories in Tony's direction, but they're at the forefront of his own mind, and he tries to wince away and can't, open and exposed as Tony sees everything. The light in Jen's eyes dims as she calls him old-fashioned, as she says, "Maybe we could hang out with people closer to our own age." As she says, "No offense, but I don't have anything in common with them."
"Oh,"
Tony says, a soft, quiet realization clouded in pity that Steve doesn't want, compassion that he doesn't want to want. "Tony," Steve says, and he's sure Tony can feel the threat of panic and desperation, the way he's just not built for anyone to be able to get inside him and know how hollow and lonely he is. "Tony's different. Tony opens up. He can't."
"For God's sake, I don't want you to go because you feel sorry for me."
The heckles go up. Tony's bristling just a bit.
"Who said anything about that, darling?"
"The inside of your head did," Steve shoots back, and then he really wishes they were still capable of social niceties, all the little lies that keep conversations running. He can feel Tony sigh, a heaving breath.
"I'll give you that," Tony says. "But they're still your friends and I want to meet them. Why wouldn't I?"
"Are you sure?" Steve asks, still trying to deflect even as he remembers he can't anymore.
"It's just a bunch of geezers swapping war stories. You'll be bored."
He thinks a bored Tony is probably a dangerous Tony. He's sure Tony is capable of making a scene wherever he goes. He really doesn't want that. He's seen Tony be brutal and cutting, snide and sarcastic. Worse, maybe he'll just show up drunk. Tony's mental voice is slightly acerbic now.
"I won't be bored."
Then there's a wave of earnestness so pure that it's startling.
"I'm really happy that you asked me,"
he says, and then there's absolute sincerity.
"Thank you."
Well, Steve wasn't expecting that. The rest of the day is more or less a loss. If Tony notices him fretting, he at least does him the courtesy of pretending not to notice. until, that is, Steve turns up early in the evening at Tony's penthouse. Jarvis eyes Steve with what Steve hopes is approval, and then Tony's there, and for an instant they're both just staring at each other. Tony cleans up real nice, Steve thinks, and then he hopes to God Tony didn't hear him think that. Tony is wearing a very expensive-looking tux. He's smiling slightly and he's completely sober. His omnipresent headache echoes inside Steve's head. That's probably the tumor. Tony's staring at him, mouth parted, eyes wide, a blue as deep as a sea, looking him up and down like he's never seen Steve in his dress uniform before.
Oh, I have, Tony assures him. But this is different.
Yeah, Steve knows what he means. If Tony has any other thoughts about the way he looks, he holds them back and Steve is grateful. He's not sure he can deal right now with Tony's interest, if Tony is even interested. The riot is quiet and Bucky and Gail meet them on the steps of the venue. Steve hugs them both and then he holds out a hand to Tony. Bucky, Gail, this is... Oh, Gail says, delighted. I saw you on television. You must be Tony. Steve's Tony. And the thing about the soul bond is that he can feel Tony's reaction as intimately as if it were his own. A surprised burst of sunshine bright joy fizzing along his nerves. Tony has always been Tony Stark, known for being SI's CEO, or these days for being Iron Man, but mostly for being himself, a billionaire, a man who needs no introduction. Tony has never been someone else's Tony before, Steve knows. He's never belonged to someone, and he likes it. It feels like intruding to know this about Tony, that this is his private, secret happiness. This is what Tony has always wanted. He tries not to think about how Tony probably wanted someone who wasn't him, someone who wouldn't mind that his soulmate was a man, someone who could be everything that Tony wants, a comfort here at the end of his days. I suppose I must be, Tony agrees with a small smile that shows only a fraction of the elation inside his head. It's so wonderful to finally meet you. He glances away, slightly abashed. I know how much Steve likes you both, and well, honestly, I always enjoyed that old movie about you. There are spots of color in his cheeks. There is a touch of actual embarrassment floating down the bond, and Steve marvels at the fact that Tony does seem to know what shame is after all. Not that he has anything to be ashamed of. Bucky laughs. You mean the one where Rita Hayworth played Gail? When Tony had told him Bucky and Gail were famous too, that there had been movies about them, about how they found each other after Steve's supposed death, it hadn't really made an impact amid everything else Steve had been trying to take in. Steve's still finding it hard to picture. Rita Hayworth had been all of the GI's favorite pin-up girl way back when, and she'd been Gail?
I told you, Tony says. Epic love story, star-studded. It wasn't a bad movie, all things considered. William Holden played you, if you were wondering. You were pretty easy on the eyes, too.
It's not the first time Tony's mentioned finding him attractive, but this, like all the others, is oblique. It's about the past, about people who weren't really him. He doesn't know if Tony doesn't like him like that now, or if Tony just doesn't want to tell him so, and he doesn't know which would be worse. That's the one, Tony says aloud, with a wink. Of course, obviously, Rita Hayworth had nothing on the real thing. Gail smiles, bright-eyed. I did suspect you'd be a flatterer, Mr. Stark. I see Steve must have warned you about me after all, Tony says smoothly, grinning now. He is perfectly and utterly charming. Oh, he's flirting, but he's Tony. He always flirts. This is apparently his nice flirting, appropriate for company. Steve didn't know he had it in him. I tell you to back off, Buster, Bucky says, Brooklyn accent layered on thick. But I think we all know that everyone here is taken. Tony chuckles. Leave me, I'm capable of forgetting it. It's strange. Serendipitous, even. Soul bonds are so rare. Most people will never meet someone who has one. They can only imagine what they must be like. There are millennia of stories, poems, songs just by people wishing for them. And yet here they are, the four of them, and they all know exactly what it's like.
Weird, isn't it? Tony asks. I mean, you kind of wonder what they're thinking about you, and then you realize you're thinking about them. It's terribly circular.
The thought floats by on a little cloud of amusement. Bucky leans in.
Say, he says, if you're actually interested, when they made that movie, they brought me and Gail to Hollywood for the premiere. If you want to come over sometime, we've got pictures of us and Rita Hayworth on the red carpet. He smiles in reminiscence. It was really something to see, I'll tell you that. He expects Tony to say no. Jen would have said no. Jen would have demurred, would have said maybe and meant no. But Tony just lights up, and Steve can feel the truth of it down the bond. He's honestly excited.
Oh, wow, he breathes. I'd love that.
His mind nudges Steve's tentatively.
Can we?
You actually want to spend time with them? Steve asks. He's still waiting for the other shoe to drop.
I actually do, Tony confirms, and he's still smiling.
Tony's on his best behavior. Better behavior than Steve could have ever expected. He's polite and charming, and he honestly seems to be enjoying himself. Hell, Steve could practically bring Tony home to his parents, setting aside the fact that they're dead and that Tony's a man, of course. He wonders if that's why Tony's pulling out all the stops. Bucky and Gail are all he's got. There's a feeling like a wry smile down the bond.
Figured me out, have you?
Inside his head, Tony laughs.
Yeah, it sort of is like meeting your family. I'd meet your actual family if I could.
Steve can't quite check the image of the cemetery, grey stone graves in the bleak winter snow and a swell of grief.
I'll meet yours if you want, he offers. Or your friends.
My parents are dead, Tony says, tersely. I don't have very many friends, and there's no way in hell I'm letting Greg get his claws in you.
Greg?
He remembers Tony's shield file. One brother, Gregory Stark, as Tony sends a fragmented image. A man who could have been Tony in reverse, a ghost, a film negative. His hair is styled the same as Tony's, goatee and all, but bleached blonde. His features are Tony's, but his face isn't. He smiles a nasty mean smile that Tony's face would never wear, and there's nothing but coldness behind it.
Identical twin.
Tony's mind is sharp and bitter, pained, and the headache that's always in him throbs more heavily.
20 minutes older, not that he'll ever let me forget it. Smarter than me, and unfathomably cruel. You wouldn't like him, darling. Let's just leave it at that.
And with that, the roast is about to start, and they're herded inside. Steve thinks maybe they both understand loneliness in their own way. The evening is nice. Tony laughs in all the right places at the other guests' joke and shares some of the only slightly embarrassing war stories, the ones fit for public consumption. Steve is pretty sure no one is ever going to let him live down the time Bucky stole his uniform and he had to fight Nazis in his underwear. Steve thinks Tony's probably sorry Bucky never got any pictures of that. The bond is full of amusement and light, pleasant enjoyment. Tony's having a good time. This is honestly making Tony happy. Steve realizes halfway through that he's actually having a good time too. He can't remember the last time he went out on a date and it was really, truly good all the way through. Maybe with Gail. He wonders, too late, if Tony minds being compared to his former fiancé.
Nah,
Tony informs him from where he's, it turns out, sitting next to Gail, cheerfully engaging her in conversation.
I'm flattered. She must have been a hell of a lady back in the day.
She was, Steve says, and he knows Tony probably doesn't want to know, but he can't help but let some of his memories shine through. Gail as she was, clever and gorgeous and kind, the way she was friendly to him when no one else was, how she was determined and driven as a reporter even when no one expected her to want to do more than get married and stay home. Tony laughs a little down the bond.
Well, at least I know you've got a type.
Oh? He's a little afraid to find out what Tony thinks his type might be.
You like him smart,
Tony replies.
It's not like Jan's PhDs are just for show either. You want someone who's good at what they do, but a good person too, and, you'd probably say feisty. The sort of person who can hold their own against you, who's not afraid to tell you what they think.
It occurs to him that they could just as easily be a description of Tony himself.
You're trying to tell me something?
There's no response from Tony, only a quiet, quick withdrawal within his head, like Tony thinks he's inadvertently crossed the line. Steve feels dizzy, off balance, and he thinks maybe Tony did. It's like Tony could have been someone he'd fallen for if Tony hadn't been. It's like the universe tried to give him someone he could have wanted after all.
Who, me? Tony says, too casually, too late. Usually people just call me an asshole. That's no one's type.
Once again, Steve doesn't know what to say to that. There's polite applause and he realizes that the evening is over. He makes himself smile for the crowd. He gets up. They leave chatting with Bucky and Gail. In his head, Tony tries gallantly to recover and he overhears Tony promising Bucky to come over and see those pictures sometime. Tony scribbling his number, his private number, on the back of a business card. In case they want to come by, Tony says. He's still trying. He's still absolutely perfectly charming. Outside, there are many more reporters than Steve expected there would be. Sure, there are sometimes a few people following him, but this? This is a crowd. The journalists are jostling for position and there is a microphone shoved in Steve's face. Hey, Steve snaps. You can't just bust in here like this. This is private. He ponders punching the nearest camera.
It's perfectly legal, darling, Tony says. Unfortunately.
He just sounds tired. Like he's been the victim of the press far, far too many times. Steve's seen Tony in all the headlines before, but it's never quite hit him until now what it must have been like to live at the center of a dozen different scandals. Do you have any comment on the Hulk situation? A reporter shouts. The closest reporter, the one with the microphone, pushes it even closer. Captain, he says, would you care to explain why you and Mr. Stark, his eyes drift to Tony, and the rest of the Ultimates repeatedly lied when you said you had no idea who the Hulk was?
Oh shit, Tony says.
The sinking feeling, the pit of Steve's stomach, could be from either of them, really. The headache is still definitely Tony's. Steve is blinking into the lights. What? Tony, far more practiced at this, steps in front of Steve like shielding him with his body will make this all go away. He holds up his palm, blocking the nearest camera. No comment, Tony says, instantly, like it's some kind of magic spell. He repeats it. No comment.
What the hell is happening?
Steve wonders.
What does it look like? Tony thinks back. Someone told the truth.
It's bad. Every major news network in the world has anonymous copies of S.H.I.E.L.D.'s files. Proof that they knew from the beginning that the Hulk who killed 800 people in Manhattan was Bruce, who had deliberately shot himself up with the serum first. Proof that they covered it all up to make themselves look like heroes, rather than like frantic people trying to clean up their own messes and fix their mistakes. There are pictures of Bruce's secure quarters, a mile below the Triskelion, where he's been confined for the past year. The files have the highest level S.H.I.E.L.D. clearances. The public wants Bruce on trial. The public wants Bruce dead. Steve knows Bruce hadn't thought the theorem would do that to him. For God's sake, he knows the man just wanted to be like him. But that's not going to save him if this goes to trial. Nothing will. 852 people died. And it's not just a question of Bruce's fate. It's also a question of what other dirty secrets could be public. There is a leak somewhere. So here they are, the Ultimates, gathered at the Triskelion for an emergency meeting, trying to figure out what to do about Bruce. Not that there's much they can do there. He's got to stand trial now that this is all public. And they need to figure out what to do about the mysterious leak. It's Thor, it's got to be. Who else would? He knew about the Hulk. And he's certainly been public enough recently about quitting the team, about his disgust for S.H.I.E.L.D. He's made that quite clear. Plus, he's probably crazy, isn't he? He thinks he's a god. Steve's seen him do his lightning and teleportation tricks, but hell, he's got that belt and that hammer doing all the work for him. Who's to say what the future is capable of?
Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, Tony says, like he's quoting something.
It's a good point. Nothing we can do to prove it right now, Fury says, when Steve ventures Thor's name. but I'd say that's a pretty educated guess. Steve stares in disbelief. You're just gonna let him get away with it? Fury folds his arms and stares right back. The Thor situation's a lot more complex than you people realize. S.H.I.E.L.D.'s been conducting a 2-year investigation into this crank, and any sudden move is gonna upset the apple cart. He pauses significantly. I say this especially for your benefit, Captain. Everyone remembers what he did to Hank. Steve feels himself smiling. He lets his expression shift the way it wants to, into something cool and deadly. What? He asks. I strike you as the kind of guy who goes looking for a fight? He hears Tony laugh inside his head. Across the table, Tony hasn't moved in the slightest. There's a memory down the bond. Him holding Tony up against the wall, one hand raised in a fist. His own face, inches from Tony's, is frozen in a cold, terrified snarl. He looks dangerous. He looks frightening, even though in the memory Tony isn't afraid. Steve didn't quite realize how it looked to be on the other end of his fists. Imagine if you'd hit me then, Tony says. There's a strange shading of admiration in his tone. What a way to soul bond. He remembers wanting to touch Tony then, wanting to touch him just for the sheer joy of irritating him. They would have bonded then if he had. He wonders just why he wanted to touch Tony so badly. He wonders if maybe, somehow, even then, he knew without consciously realizing it. Even then, he knew what was hidden between them. He can't punch him now, of course. It would hurt both of them, and he doesn't want to, either. He does want to punch Thor.
Dag afterwards, would you please?
Tony asks.
I'd rather not enjoy the fist fight, if at all possible.
Oh, Tony would have to feel that too. Everything he feels, even the pain. Steve glances sidelong at him.
If you want me not to go,
there's a faint smile on his face.
Darling, I know better than to think I could ever stop you.
That's settled then. Time to find Thor. Finding Thor turns out to be the easy part. Thor is ensconced in a club near Times Square. A packed room, men and women writhing on the dance floor, illuminated by flashing multicolored bright lights. Half of them are clutching beer bottles, sloshing their mixed drinks. The other half stumble, dazed, blissed out on drugs Steve wouldn't even be able to name. The music pounds in Steve's head, out of sync with Tony's headache. This is really more Tony's sort of place than his, he thinks, as he scowls at a scantily clad woman, some of whom drape themselves over suited men who sprawl across the seats in the shadowy corners. He's sure Tony would be happy here.
Not so much anymore,
Tony whispers the correction in the back of his mind.
I'm taken, remember?
There is that. When he finds Thor, he has to raise his voice to be heard over the music. Where the hell do you get off leaking classified information like this? Steve spits out the accusation and Thor doesn't so much as flinch. He doesn't even turn around to face Steve. He just glances at him over his shoulder. He asks coolly if Steve's come to beat him up.
There are some people out there bigger than Giant Man, you know, Thor says. We don't all crumble at the sight of some clown in a flak.
Steve remembers Tony's palm on his chest. Tony smiling at him, dark and dangerous and unafraid, flirting with him like sex was a weapon.
They don't all crumble, indeed.
In his mind, Tony has the grace to wince. There's a sense of regret, but no actual words. Steve shakes it off and steps forward. Calmly, Thor tells him he's been to the Triskelion 3 times in his life. He tells him he doesn't know enough about computers to even begin to hack S.H.I.E.L.D. He chuckles.
I'm the most vocal opponent of the death penalty in this country. Do you really think I'd just hand over Banner to your cowboy president for public lynching?
He has a point, darling, Tony observes. No means no motive. You stay out of this,
Steve snaps back. You just watch your step, Goldilocks, he tells Thor. You've had access to a lot of privileged information these last 18 months, and if you do anything to compromise this country's security...
He leaves the threat unfinished. He lets his hands curl into fists. He lets anger flow through him, hot and raw, leaving a pure clarity in its wake. Good versus evil. Simplicity. He knows how to handle this. He may be here in this strange future with an even stranger soul bond, but this is his element. He wreaks violence the same way Tony works a crowd. This is what he knows how to do. Sweetheart, Tony murmurs, and this time, terrifyingly, the pet name almost sounds fond. We've got to find you some better coping mechanisms.
Shut up, Steve says. His point made, ultimatum delivered, he turns to leave. One of the revelers is in his path, a girl with blue hair. She stops him.
Hey, soldier, she calls out. Steve glances down.
Hmm?
She spits in his face.
That's for working for the thief in chief, she yells, and then she pours her beer over his head.
After that, it all devolves into shouting and more beer washing over Steve, splashed in his face, pouring down his uniform. He hadn't expected this. He staggers back, squinting, eyes stinging. He's not here to punish civilians. He doesn't know what to do.
Enough, Thor roars, and as Steve finally manages to focus, he sees Thor up out of his seat. Above him, the ceiling of the club crackles with lightning. However he's doing it, it has to be a trick. Technology. Hell, Tony can probably do the same thing with his armor. The crowd falls silent. Thor's still talking, berating the crowd, and Steve's over here trying to wipe the beer off his face.
That was humiliating, that was what that was. Jesus, is this how they see him? Is this how everyone sees him since he gave that press conference? Do they think they can just push him around?
Maybe they can. A small frightened thought drifts through Steve's head. Maybe they know he's weak. They know what he really is. They know they can get away with this. God, maybe they're right. He's dizzy, he doesn't know what to do.
Down the bond there is a soft pulse of calmness, reassurance.
Shh, Tony breathes.
It's okay. Shit happens. It's going to be okay.
There is the smallest undercurrent of, no one thinks less of you, at least not for being with me, that Steve doesn't know what to do with. It's small enough, luckily, that Steve can ignore it.
Thor's walking toward him.
Are you okay, Rogers?
Fine, Steve spits out. Everything smells like beer.
But some of your friends here could use a little lesson in manners.
Heedless of the mess, Thor pats him on the shoulder.
I'm sorry about this. I really didn't want that to happen. And I was serious when I said I had nothing to do with outing Banner, he leans in.
That said, I think I know who might have released those files.
Who?
Thor's eyes light up in a way that isn't entirely sane.
My evil half-brother Loki, a messenger from Asgard, came to warn me that he escaped from his bonds again and journeyed to Midgard to do everything he could to.
Oh Jesus, he can't be serious.
Steve raises a hand.
Thor, please.
What?
Steve looks him in the eye.
Just shut up.
He's crazy, that's it. He's fucking crazy, that's all there is to it. He looks like he honestly believes he's telling the truth. Like he thinks he's really, truly a Norse god come to life. Delusions of grandeur, isn't that what they call it?
Unfazed, Thor stares right back.
You go to church every Sunday, Captain. What I've got to say is no stranger than that.
Okay, that's just insulting.
Thor, I saw you and Tony on television the other day, Thor says, and despite himself, Steve goes cold, wondering what Thor thinks of him, if Thor's going to tell him he's not a real man. But Thor just smiles a small, lopsided smile.
Congratulations. It was a lovely announcement, and I enjoyed your speech. You had such passion in your heart, Captain. You spoke so strongly, so earnestly about how you believed soul bonds were a gift from God.
He makes a quiet humming noise.
You really believe that?
Steve's caught out, but he's not going to lie about his faith.
Of course I do.
The words are quiet when he says them. He thinks maybe that he can feel Tony's happiness.
And you have proof,
Thor says, with another twitch of a smile. Isn't that marvelous? Your wondrous miracle, why it happened to you. Your god granted you this power of telepathy. Your god gave you the ability to know your soulmate's thoughts. Are you mocking me? Steve asks, throat so tight that his voice nearly cracks on the words. Thor holds up his hands. Not at all, he says, like he's hastening to calm Steve down, like he knows he's going about this the wrong way. I just mean, you believe in miracles. You believe in the numinous. You believe that men can be touched by the divine. You believe, in fact, that you have been personally. And yet you are unwilling to extend me the same courtesy of belief. That's different, Steve says, flatly. Soul bonds are as old as humanity. Even if Steve didn't believe they were God-given, no one would be able to deny that they existed. What Thor is asking him to believe goes far beyond that. It's absurd, it's ridiculous. I don't know, Tony says. He makes a good argument. Steve blinks. You can't possibly believe a single word he says. I believe him when he says he had nothing to do with Banner, Tony counters. As for the rest, I mean, I don't know if I believe what he says, but he does have a decent line of argumentation. You're an atheist, Steve shoots back, because he picked that fact up from Tony's head pretty quickly. What the hell do you know? Shouldn't you be telling me gods don't exist? The reply Steve gets is the mental equivalent of a raised eyebrow. Shouldn't you be telling me that they do? Steve realizes his mouth is hanging open. He realizes Thor is still watching him. For God's sake, he just wants to go home and shower. We'll be watching you, Steve says aloud. Don't try anything. He turns and walks away, leaving Thor behind him. That didn't go at all like he thought it was going to. After that, everything seems to happen with blinding speed. It feels like it's hardly any time at all before the team is gathered in Tony's penthouse for what surely has to be the worst Ultimates party ever, watching Bruce's trial. Tony invited them over because, so he said, he had the largest television, but his mind is literally an open book to Steve, and Steve knows he just didn't want to be alone. Even so, Tony's sitting as far away from him as he possibly can, so it's clearly not Steve's company he wants. In fact, Tony's sitting next to Natasha. Steve tries not to take it personally, though it's hard not to when he knows Tony misses her. It shouldn't matter. It's not like he wants Tony. Why should it matter to him who Tony wants? And yet it prickles unpleasantly, like an itch just under his skin, this odd jealousy. What? Tony says without even looking in his direction. Come on, you can't tell me you don't want to stay on good terms with your exes. I know you, Wizard Gale. There's a flash of an image. Natasha in Tony's workshop, surrounded by armor pieces and then a syringe in Tony's hands. Speaking as her teammate, I'm outfitting her with a variant of my own armor and the same nanomachinery I've injected into my own veins. It's purely professional, sweetheart. No need to grind your teeth like that. Steve unclenches his jaw. He hadn't even realized he was grinding his teeth. The nanomachinery thing also gives him the willies, frankly, but he figured that, being someone who spent 6 months as a guinea pig of the Army Super Soldier program, he doesn't exactly have a leg to stand on about complaining. On screen, Bruce's lawyer is compelling, but the prosecution is utterly ruthless, insisting, of course, that Bruce must pay for the Hulk's crimes. These were the acts of a single individual, he says. And that individual must pay the ultimate price. Funny things, euphemisms. They want Bruce dead. These people who have never killed anyone, who don't have the slightest clue how it feels, they want Bruce to die at their command and they can't even say it. Turn it off, Jen says, disgusted. Steve changes the channel. They all know how it's going to be anyway. Banner's never going to get away with this, Tony says, draining his martini. That blind lawyer he found himself makes great TV, but it's really just a formality at this stage. Natasha mutters something under her breath about doom and gloom, but really, can't you see where this is going? Of course he's going down, Steve says. They need a scapegoat. Glad you finally agree with me about something, Tony says.
I wish it could be under better circumstances.
Steve watches Tony get up and fix himself another drink. It's that kind of day. When he looks up, Thor's on screen being interviewed on one of the news programs. He's saying the trial is a distraction.
The real atrocity in the cards, he says, is superhuman troops and so-called rogue states. Our primary concern should be rumors of the Ultimates being deployed in Syria and Iran. His gaze implores the audience. This team wasn't put together to stop burglars and bank robbers.
Natasha laughs and gestures at the screen.
What a moron. Can you believe I actually planned to seduce that crank when I first joined the team?
If she's admitting to that, well, that doesn't exactly reflect well.
Tony, he says, very cautiously. Are you sure she didn't set out to seduce you?
Tony shrugs mentally.
I know you don't want me, darling, but that doesn't mean no one else ever did. And even if she did, what of it? It's over.
Steve becomes aware that the rest of the team is looking at him.
Oh, right, the Ultimates, overseas. I'm a soldier, he says aloud. I follow orders. If they deploy us, I'm going.
Jen looks at him the same way Natasha had been looking at Thor on the television, like she can't even understand what she ever saw in him.
Yeah, she says. That's what got everyone worried.
Bruce's trial lasts 9 days. The verdict is swift and unanimous. And then, of course, it falls to the Ultimates to carry it out. No one else can. He's already in S.H.I.E.L.D. custody, after all. In his final assignment for the Ultimates, Hank dosed him up with a tranquilizer, and Fury delivered it, and now they're hauling his unconscious body out of a helicopter onto a deserted aircraft carrier in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. He thinks he's gone free. He won't wake up. He won't even know. They lied to him. They couldn't risk him changing again. It's terrible all around. They used to be teammates. Now they're his executioners. And Tony is in charge of arming the bomb. He's seen the schematics in Tony's head for the past few days whenever he's bothered to look through Tony's eyes. Tony's mind has been echoing with a slow, miserable pulse of grief, with diagrams, with the smooth shells of missile casings, words like thermonuclear and 1 megaton yield. Tony doesn't deserve this. He doesn't deserve to be the one who does this, but he's the only one of them who can. Steve sets Bruce's body down on the deck. His team, his responsibility. It should be him doing this. It can't be. Tony's standing next to him, suited up. He flew in. He's going to set the time and fly out on his own.
This is rotten, Steve says, and he feels the grim answering reply of Tony's agreement.
The bomb, a huge and ugly thing, towers over them on the deck.
You should get going,
Tony says aloud as they look down. Bruce's chest rises and falls as he breathes.
You don't want to be here when the party starts, Cap.
The vocal filters mask all audible emotion, but Steve doesn't need to be able to hear him to tell that his mind is a swirl of grief. Steve wants to comfort him, but he doesn't have the faintest idea how. Steve nods once, curtly, and turns back to the waiting copter, where Hank's staring off into the distance and Betty Ross is crying on Fury's shoulder. They take off and Tony stares up at them for long seconds, helmet tilted at the sky before turning to walk toward the bomb as they lift off and fly away. It's a clear, bright day as the helicopter zooms away from the carrier. The sun glints off the water. In Steve's set, Tony is crouching over controls, double-checking settings. He's taking his time. There's an instant where Tony pauses, staring down at the board in front of him, and Steve knows this is it. He feels Tony shut his eyes, swallow, and then Tony reaches out and turns the key. The board lights up. 5 minutes. 4 minutes 59 seconds. Tony is walking from the bomb to where Bruce is still lying on the deck, and he looks down. In front of Steve, inside the helicopter, Fury has one hand on his headset, and Steve knows they're talking. Even he can't hear the conversation, not while they're in flight, but he can get it all from Tony's head.
It just feels obscene, Tony says.
Fury sighs.
Steve hears as half of the conversation from Tony's mind.
We've been over this a million times. Banner murdered over 800 innocents.
I know, Tony says, and there's nothing in his mind but bleak grief. All Steve can see for an instant is the sun shining off the cross in Bruce's fist.
And people wonder why I drink.
God, Steve thinks. Tony, that's not fair. When the helicopter lands, Fury's still talking, although this time Steve can actually hear him. T-minus 3 minutes. Better get out of there, Stark. Safe zone's 15 miles with a 1 megaton bomb. Tony has to know that. Steve breathes in and breathes out, relieved as Tony launches himself into the sky. Tony, he ventures, as he feels Tony erring toward him.
Are you okay?
Peachy keen, darling, Tony says, though the thought is shaky. I'll be there in a minute. Tony lands, stumbling, the least graceful Steve has ever seen from him, and the sky goes white behind him as the bomb detonates. Tony wavers on his feet.
Tony?
I'm fine, Tony says. Come on, we don't want to miss a funeral after all. Tony tamps down on his pain like he can keep it in, like he thinks Steve can't feel him. As it turns out, the Ultimates are also the only people who bother to show up to Bruce's funeral later that day. Everything was already arranged. S.H.I.E.L.D. wants to put this behind them as fast as possible. The coffin's empty, of course. They already know there's nothing left of him. Steve stands up there and gives a eulogy while the rest of the team looks back at him from the deserted pews. Bruce wrote it himself, a surprisingly eloquent statement about his faith, about the afterlife, concluding with asking the team to remember him. Steve's voice only shakes a little as he reads it. Tony sits there, head down, and never once looks at him. It's evening by the time the funeral is over. The sky is dismal and the rain is pouring down. Ahead of him, Steve can hear Fury telling Betty Ross how they'll hit all the bars, see Bruce off in style. Jen glances at Steve once before sidling under Hank's umbrella. Well, Steve supposes it's not his place to say, but if she shows up with bruises, he's breaking that son of a bitch's jaw again. It's only him and Tony on the steps of the church. Tony's got his own umbrella, of course. He knows what Tony's thinking about, his mind circling around the execution. Bruce on the deck, Tony's own hands arming the bomb. Tony's mind is an unending spiral of grief. Hey, Steve says, and Tony glances up like he wasn't expecting audible speech. You're going to drown your sorrows? I'm sure Nick and Betty wouldn't mind the company. Tony shakes his head. There is a faint, sad smile on his face. Not sure it would do me any good, he murmurs. No, I just want... His mouth snaps shut. What? Steve asks, when Tony doesn't even venture the rest of it in his head. Tony edges closer to him. The umbrellas bump and Tony hoists his higher. His eyes are very wide, his face too pale.
It's nothing. It's not nothing. Come on.
Tony sighs.
I don't want to be by myself. It's silly. I know you don't want to.
There is that same sad longing again. Loneliness, more grief.
It's not a come on, I swear. I really just want company, but I know you wouldn't so...
No, I want to. Steve says, surprising even himself.
Come on, let's get out of the rain.
At Tony's penthouse, Jarvis looks happier to see him than he has any other time Steve has met him. He even smiles as he ushers Steve in and then ostentatiously closes the door and leaves the two of them alone. I think he's glad you're here, Tony says, in answer to the question Steve didn't even need to bother asking aloud. I think he worries I'm not being treated right. He thinks my soulmate should be a certain way, I don't know. Tony smiles a small, almost embarrassed smile and scuffs the hardwood floor with his toe. He's dripping water on everything. Yeah, well, they already knew Steve wasn't what Tony wanted, didn't they? In lieu of any reply to Steve's glum thought, Tony heads into the other room.
Do you want to dry off and borrow a rope, darling? I have plenty. Some of them might even fit you.
He knows what Tony's clothing choices are. His robes are soft, elegant, hedonistic. The kind of thing someone buys to make themselves feel good, to feel comfortable. He glances down at his own familiar army uniform. He's not even that damp. He'll be okay. It feels like it would be giving something up somehow to enjoy himself.
Fine, thanks.
A couple minutes later, Tony comes back in a soft red robe. He sits on the couch that overlooks the huge windows. His million-dollar view of rainy, dismal Manhattan, and Stephen knows without even thinking about it that Tony wants him there, next to him. Tony doesn't look up as Steve settles down on the cushion. Tony breathes in, breathes out heavily, and says nothing. Even his mind is perfectly quiet, like the surface of a lake. Steve can feel the slow sadness blossom underneath. The first time I killed someone, Steve says, very quietly, I was 20. Tony's breath now was sharp, pained.
Steve.
Down the bond there's something that might be sympathy, might be commiseration. It was right after Project Rebirth, actually, about 30 seconds after. Steve's hands are on his thighs and he can't look up. He doesn't need to look at Tony to know what Tony's thinking. A Nazi spy put a bullet through my shoulder and then shot Dr. Erskine and I just went for him. I couldn't think. I don't remember being in pain, though I must have been. I just remember being angry and afraid. And I remember breaking his neck. He doesn't think he's ever said it so plainly. All my life I'd been so weak, and I just reached out and snapped his neck, like a twig. His fingers dig into his thighs. I still remember how it felt under my hands. It was so easy. It was terrifying how easy it was. I used to wonder what it would be like killing for my country, and it turned out it wasn't anything like I thought it was going to be at all. He hears himself chuckle. I bet they made a movie of it, didn't they? He glances up. Tony's mouth quirks and there's a dry amusement in Tony's mind.
Dozens of them.
I was shaking afterwards for hours, Steve admits. I was overwhelmed, I suppose, sick to my stomach. I couldn't stop feeling it, like it was still in my bones. It was all I could see over and over.
The movies never showed that part,
Tony says. Steve shuts his eyes.
If I could have backed out right then, I think maybe I would have,
he thinks, picking out each word precisely for Tony. He's never told anyone this. He never felt smaller or more scared in that moment when he should have been glorying in his new powerful body. In the movies, the hero was always spurred on by injustice, by vengeance, and he had been. He'd wanted to hurt the goddamn crowds like they'd hurt him, Erskine, in America. But he'd been so frightened, too.
I couldn't, though. I was already in. No going back. They'd already told me about the Shitori.
I did kill a few Shitori, Tony volunteers, after a long pause.
You know this is different, Steve says. It gets easier, he adds. I wish it didn't sometimes, but it does, just like anything else. But this, I think this part was always going to be rotten. It shouldn't have been you.
Tony scrapes his hand over his face.
Some days I still think I can't do this.
Steve looks at him, feels the exhaustion and the pain down the bond, takes the breath and holds out his hand.
Come here.
What?
Here,
Steve repeats, stretching his arm over the back of the couch.
Lean back, I've got you.
He can feel the disbelief in Tony's mind, but he knows Tony needs this too. After a few seconds, Tony scoots back, pressing himself up against Steve's side, tipping his head back against Steve's shoulder. It's a vulnerable position. Tony's throat is bared, a long, elegant sweep of skin. The bond lights up and pulls them tighter as Tony nestles himself into Steve's embrace. He can feel everything pouring off Tony, waves of sorrow and fatigue and that ever-familiar throbbing pain in his skull, the tumor growing, making his head pound like the ticking of a clock.
Doomsday clock, Tony says.
and down the bond there's a wretched little pulse of dark humor. It's a reference Steve doesn't understand, even after Tony draws a picture in his head, a stylized clock with the hands at 2 minutes to midnight.
Never mind, more atomic than I need to think about today anyway.
And before Steve can stop him, his mind shifts to his hands arming the bomb again, to the mushroom cloud in the skies. Steve swallows hard and pushes back. Iceland, the Nazi rocket, watching the explosion above him as he falls away.
What do you know? Tony says,
and his mouth twitches like he wants to smile.
We've got a few things in common. It's going to be okay, Steve tells him. It is.
He can't think about Tony dying. He can't. Of course, Tony knows everything, even the things he's trying to hide, and there's a small answering ripple of sadness. There's nothing either of them can do about that.
Hey, Tony says, hesitantly. Do you mind if I...
Tony's eyes are already falling shut, and Steve can feel him struggling not to give in to the exhaustion.
Go on,
Steve tells him, as gently as he can.
Get some sleep, I'll watch your back.
Tony shuts his eyes and turns his face into Steve's shoulder, like he trusts him. He's out like a light. Steve feels only the easy rhythm of Tony's unconscious mind when he checks the bond. He doesn't know if he's doing this right. He doesn't know if he's doing anything right, but it feels right. He supposes that's as good a sign as anything else.
You can't find him, the way is dim. You feel like giving up. You ache for her, rest assured. It's never too late for love. You say you're tired. How I hate to hear you use that word every time it hurts. You say you're tired. How I hate to hear you use that word. Everybody hurts. Who am I to say? I know the way you feel. I've felt your pain, and I know your sorrow. You could try to let the past slip away. Live for today. Don't stop believing.